Sean.
Hey.
You're feeling kind of sleepy.
I am.
You're feeling a little bit drowsy.
Oh, I am.
And you're listening to my voice.
Oh, wow. This is crazy.
And when I say 3, 2, 1, you're under my control, Sean.
Okay. I don't believe this would work, but let's try it.
I hate tuna sandwiches. Oh. Say, I hate tuna sandwiches.
I hate tuna sandwiches. You didn't say 3, 2, 1.
Did I not say 3, 2, 1? God, I make a terrible hypnotist.
Welcome to Smartless.
Smart.
Will, you just recently moved out of your house.
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, so listener, so Will moved out of his house, but he still he has a recording booth there in the house because he does make a grip on voiceover work. And so he's asked this new owner if he can come in and use his audio studio.
That is hilarious. Wait, so it's different families living there right now, but you're in there with them?
Yeah, I just met the new owners as I came up, and they let me, and they agreed to, for the next week, let me continue to use what I call my booth. It's technically their booth.
You're joking,
right? No. But you're watching people living in your kitchen as of last week. Was your kitchen, your living room, everything?
I just met them in what is now their kitchen.
I don't know. How do you deal with that?
Well, luckily, I'm very cut off emotionally. So I don't let that, but it was very strange. Like they open the door, come on in into a house. I built this house, mm-hmm. as you know.
Well, a container crane did.
Oh yeah. Don't get Kimmel started on me building this.
You know, Sean, his house is one of those kind of new, fancy, modern, we're just going to stack a bunch of glass boxes on each other.
Oh yeah. No, I saw it. It's like a Costco
prefab.
I went shopping in there.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful house. It was on the cover of Dwell Mag. I don't need to sell it anymore. I already sold it.
Yeah, you did.
But it's
any of your personal things still there that they're rummaging through, or
just in this? It's like I'm in the Vatican. You know, like I'm just I've got this little oasis here, this little temple inside their house, and. I will admit this. I came up here and they were like, you can use, by the way, these people are so nice and so, so sweet. And they said, yeah, feel free to use it the next week. Don't, all good. And then I get in here and they're downstairs in the kitchen. I was like, I really got to take a leak. Like, I wonder if they'll know if I just pop around the corner. And I did. I popped around, like just tiptoeing around in what 1 week ago was my house.
That's so crazy.
Tiptoeing in to take a leak. It was very odd. It's very odd. But I will say the kindness, it reaffirmed my faith in humanity. These people are very sweet to let me continue to do this.
That's nice.
So I'm very nervous. I know that you have heard me introduce guests before by saying, today's guest is going to really class us up. But today, it has never been more true.
Yep.
I have been an admirer of this man for as long as I have been smart enough to admire smart people, which is sadly only the second half of my life. This man has won, among other awards, the Pulitzer Prize and the George Polk. Okay. He started his career in journalism at the Washington Post in 1982. He covered Metro, sports, style. Then in 1988, he became their Moscow correspondent.
I'm not smart enough.
This is a number.
In 1992, he became a staff writer at The New Yorker, and a short 6 years later was named editor, a position he remains in to this day.
You got to be kidding.
Only one of five people to hold that title in the magazine's 100-year history. He's one of our smartest and most cultured thinkers that we have today, and I have zero idea why he said yes to the big swing he took when I asked him to join us. Friends, please welcome Mr. David Remnick.
David? Oh, my gosh, David Remnick.
No way.
Oh, there he
look
is.
Look at this. Look at this man.
Wait, David, you look so young to be only one of five editors in the history of The New Yorker. Is that true?
I'm not the only one.
No, no, no.
You know, some die off and some retire.
Yeah, but I'm just saying, like, that's 25 years or something.
It's kind of incredible. We've been around for 95 years or something, and the first two, Harold Ross went for 25 years or so, and William Shawn for 30-odd years, 35 years or something.
David, how long have you been editor?
23 years.
Wow.
Jeez, that's what I'm saying.
Older than any pair of khakis that any of you have.
Sure.
Khaki, you can put some mileage on khakis because they really don't fade in any sort of substantial way.
So I'm going to get in. I'm going to get right into the New Yorker and in my own subscription and my battle with my subscription with the New Yorker for many years.
Here we go.
Which is the shame I would feel when I'd be like, well, first of all, the victory I would feel when I'd read an entire issue, and then the shame I'd go away and I'd get behind, and then they'd pile up, and then I'd have on my counter,
I've never
sort
heard
of
this
north
before.
Of 40,
Never, not once.
And I'd be like, I gotta get to that. Now I gotta get to that. And then I would ultimately have to put them in the recycling, and I'd think, I never got to all 10 of these.
Throwing
I never
away
got to
all
these.
That knowledge.
This is our editorial, this is our highest editorial aspiration. Number one, to make you feel really bad.
Terrible, always.
Yourself. And number two, to feed the recycling bin.
So I feed the recycling, keep the subscription, which is now here's how I figured it out. Now I'm on a digital.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I'm now on the digital.
Pretty slick.
Very slick. But I have, the New Yorker is one of the, of course, I mean.
But you guys should talk. I think Netflix rolls over too. I don't notice like myself getting a bill in the mail from Netflix. So, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're all on the same deal.
Sure.
Now, David, there's no way that you can read every issue cover to cover.
Yeah, I don't have to make a TV show or anything else. This is what I do. That's the great pleasure is to read the stuff, and I read it multiple times. And in addition to the thing you get in the mail or the what's known as the issue, the weekly issue, we also publish a whole bunch of things every day online on NewYorker.com. So it's the reading is increased.
Yeah.
So David, when you started as a journalist, I imagine what was your trajectory? You had an illustrious academic career.
Since it was denied to me playing second base for the Yankees or being a supermodel, that's what I wanted to do. I don't know about you guys, but once in a while you meet somebody who ended up doing exactly what they wanted to do since they were a kid. And in high school we had a high school newspaper, and I went to a place called Pascack Valley, and the mascot, and it's a terrible word to use now, mascot, is the Indians, and the newspaper was called, wait for it, The Smoke Signal, no one was interested in this newspaper except for me, and I used to write, I don't know, two-thirds of it using fake names and so on, and do it on my kitchen table in the days when you printed these things out and cut them in columns and pasted it, and I knew I wanted to do this. I love the idea of going out into the world and, in a sense, hiding behind a notebook. In other words, engaging with the world but having a kind of purpose and come back with your material and make something of it. That seemed like an exciting thing to do. Mm-hmm. And nobody that my parents knew did such a thing, considered such a thing. My parents thought this was insane, insane.
Was the draw to that more just a simple, dry reporting of the facts of news, or were you confident enough, interested enough at that age to weave in some opinion, to sort of editorialize?
I wasn't that sophisticated. I was a kid, but it gave me I grew up in a really boring town, kind of Springsteen North, that kind of Jersey, dull, and it was with no ocean. And close to New York, but a million miles away. So everything that was exciting was across the river. The world seemed to be across the river. And so how do you get to that? And I didn't come from an incredibly sophisticated or intellectual family. I came from a family, though, that had, you were meant to aspire.
Yeah.
Right. Right? What did your parents do, David?
My father had a very small dental practice, and to be perfectly glum about it, my mother was sick. She had MS, and eventually my father lost his dental practice because he had Parkinson's. You don't want a Parkinsonian dentist unless you want Buster Keaton as your dentist.
You can get a deal.
You can get a really good deal. I can show you the papers. And so it was a difficult situation.
Yeah.
And they wanted me to do something incredibly secure, be a lawyer or a doctor. That was the range of it.
Was that the attraction to reading, though, the sort of that escapism, getting into a book?
Yeah, or all of it, radio, TV. Radio in those days, when I was a kid, and I'm older than you guys, was...
You don't look at David. Look at you. Look how hydrated.
And So I would listen to these. Obviously, rock and roll was in the air, but also there were weird radio stations like Pacifica radio stations, and you would kind of, the counterculture would come in by listening to it at 2 o'clock in the morning as an adolescent, you know, who couldn't sleep. And so it was excitement, but it was over there. And right. there was somehow the idea that journalism would get you over there.
Get you over there. But kind of to what Jason was saying about the reading, do you suspect that there was, whether you were writing or you were editing the school paper, was there a part of you maybe now, or have you ever thought about the idea that you were recreating by observing other lives and actually by, you know, putting together this newspaper, you were creating a life or a world that was different from the world you were existing at the moment?
I think that's right on the money. Yeah. That's right on the money. And I also it was not given to me to have the self-confidence or to live in a world where people were artists.
Right. Mm-hmm.
My parents knew people who sold things or fixed things or ran a store or something like that. The idea that somebody would be an artist was preposterous and laughable and just otherworldly. So a journalist seemed like a middle ground. You know what I mean? You could make a living at it. There was a job that you could occupy. You could work at a newspaper or something like that.
Right.
And a proximity to the artist, but also another foot firmly in sort of establishment. Yeah.
I knew from a very young age, in some intuitive way, that I would have to make some sort of living to, quite frankly, to support them, much less myself.
Right.
And that's what ended up being the case.
You know, Duddy Kravitz, The Apprenticeship of Duddy Kravitz.
I know it all too well.
It's so good. And that great line of, like, a man is nothing unless he owns land. Like that thing, like, you have to do something. You have to own land. You have to do.
Well, I just had to make sure that they somehow got to the end of their lives. You know, we don't, I hate to turn all terribly serious on you, but we live in a political system where if you are weak or sick or left behind, you're in deep trouble. Mm-hmm. Whether it's about health insurance or it's about a minimum amount of income or whatever. And I could see that coming like a freight train.
Yeah.
You started it. So I this is where I want to go. Sure. And we can lighten it up as we go through it, if we want to, but
no, we're going
to
go darker.
I want to use your brain for a second here. So I know that there's no solid answer for this, but I would love your perspective on, in your gut, do you think that we are now currently in a period nationally that is temporary, you know, an anomaly that will make for interesting retrospection? Or do you think that we are in potentially the first chapter of what may be an endless story about two tribes without a happy ending? Potentially.
I mean, if we're let's ruin everybody's mood right away. let's idea. Just kill it. Let's just.
Yeah, it's a good idea.
Yeah.
Well, because then it's only up from there.
Exactly.
Yes, good.
It's kind of a rhythmic thing.
Yeah.
It's never going to get more glum than this, listener.
What we've just gone through this year and a half is a rehearsal. A rehearsal. The pandemic is a rehearsal, not just for other pandemics, but for climate change. And if we don't get our shit together, politically, environmentally, we are going to face something that there's no vaccine for.
Right. Mm-hmm.
There's no vaccine for. That's number one. Number two, we're living in a period where we're playing very fast and loose with the greatest gift we have. This is a country that had the great gift, despite all its problems and slavery and so much more, of a period of Enlightenment philosophers who gave us something called liberal democratic society.
Yeah.
And we are in the process of willy-nilly seeing it being thrown out the window by the, I think we can go into that if you want at some point, or we can talk about the cartoons in The New Yorker.
Well,
I want to talk about it.
And I think that we're in a moment also of a racial reckoning that's long in coming, or it's happened every so often, but now it's at its next stage. That's extremely serious. So that's just three big things.
And isn't it interesting though, because I always, whenever I hear, you know, I'm a news junkie just as much as the other person until I realize I can't do anything about any of it except vote. And that's what really is.
Yeah, I don't think that's true.
Oh my God, it's so frustrating. Sure, we can go out and protest, we can do these things, but all we have the power to do is vote. Otherwise, we're just filled with anger all day long.
I think you also have the power to make art.
Yeah.
To protest.
For sure.
To be funny in ways that are provocative.
Thank right. you.
I have no illusion that The New Yorker, which has a circulation of 1.3 million and then maybe 4 or 5 million people read it, I have no illusion that this is going to, you know, be a conversion experience throughout the United States, much less in, you know, red America. I'm not deluded. But each person, each in their own way, can play some kind of role. That's what the whole thing is about anyway, in large measure. And if you give in to resignation or give up the game, each in your own way, then maybe we didn't deserve it in the first place.
We get support from Happy Egg. I love starting my morning off with farm-fresh eggs full of flavor. At Happy Egg, all of their hens roam on 8 or more acres of land, leaving no mystery to why their eggs are the best. These hens are raised on 8+ acres. I got to keep it down because if my hens find out, they don't have 8+ acres. My hens only have like 3/4 of an acre. And they're going to go on strike. Anyway, all of their hens are cared for by small family farmers and live their best hen lives day in and day out. All of this results in eggs with plump orange yolks that are full of flavor. I just, as I mentioned, I like to kick off my morning with farm fresh eggs. The difference is so glaring between an egg from Happy Egg and an egg that just came from clearly some kind of like sad factory. And you just have to taste it for yourself. If you're a fan of eggs, which I am, do yourself this favor and try Happy Egg eggs. You will not be disappointed. You will notice the difference immediately. Get with the Happy Eggs. They're so good. Next time you're at the store, look for the yellow carton. Choose Happy with Happy Egg. Visit happyegg.com/smartless to find a store near you. And if you come by the house, don't mention it to my aunts. Thank you to one of our new sponsors, My Mochi Ice Cream, for supporting the show. I just discovered cookies and cream, My Mochi Ice Cream, and I'm a little obsessed, but I'm a lot obsessed. Do you not know what My Mochi Ice Cream is? Picture this. It's a perfect little scoop of rich, creamy, premium ice cream wrapped in the softest, sweetest dough known to mankind. My Mochi Ice Cream is sweet, it's chewy, it's cool, it's creamy, all at the same time. It comes in tons of fabulous flavors like strawberry, mango, cookies and cream, and double chocolate. That cookies and cream, I've always been a cookies and cream fan, but then when I had the My Mochi, oh my gosh, I mean, I was like, my mouthy loved it, first of all. An absolute knockout. Each box of My Mochi ice cream has 6 perfectly portioned mochis that are gluten-free and about 90 calories each. You can find My Mochi at Target or go to mymochi.com to find your nearest grocery store. Discover the cool, creamy, joyfully chill sensation of My Mochi ice cream today. We get support from Canva. When your work, presentations, and docs look good, you look good. And you can design stunning work presentations, docs, whiteboards, and videos with Canva. Canva is an easy-to-use online design platform. It helps people design compelling visual content and is great for designing any type of presentation and great for any teammate. So our team at Smartless is using Canva when they're coming up with different design concepts for various things related to Smartless and Smartless Media, because we have a lot of stuff going on. It's a busy crew, okay? And if it wasn't for Canva, they'd all be fired. Supercharge your work with AI-powered Canva presentations, docs, videos, and more. In just a few seconds, you can generate slides and text from a prompt. AI is built into Canva right where you work, so you can stay on task without any app switching. It's AI that's easy to learn and even easier to use. Whether you work in sales, marketing, HR, ops, and more, Canva is perfect for any work task. Sales decks, hiring docs, marketing brainstorms, employee videos, you name it. Anyone at work can design with Canva. Start designing today at canva.com. Designed for work.
And now back to the show.
So, you know, somebody in The New Yorker who I really enjoy, who plays around with a lot of the themes that we talk about, but in a really delightful way, is Andy Borowitz and the Borowitz Report. Can you talk a little bit, did he predate your becoming editor of The New Yorker?
Yeah, so Andy, you know Andy's career.
Did he create the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air?
So my understanding is he was at the Harvard Lampoon.
Right.
And I think he either met Bud Yorkin or Norman Lear or somebody like that through that high office. And he wrote a treatment for or some kernel of what became the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air eventually. And, you know, which, by the way, I think pays better than freelance writing. And
sure. Creating a TV show in the 90s? Yeah.
Yeah. Sure. Lots of episodes, guy named Will Smith, et cetera,
et cetera. We're not throwing a benefit for Andy anytime soon.
Well, I would never ask him. But what is it? You have to go over 100 episodes and then it's just then gold.
Not anymore. Nobody cares.
The honeypot. Yeah.
So, and I think Andy, you know, is able, like The Onion and like a lot of our best comedians, are able to see the absolute absurdity in political life. And he does it through this headline form. And he's pretty hilarious.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's hilarious. I find it's so delightful, and I find it to be so...
We kind of brought him, he had his own gig online, and we kind of brought him into The New Yorker. He was always at around The New Yorker. He was doing things for The New Yorker, but the constancy... it was brought from his, I guess, what used to be called a blog, and
then brought on, right. So now that we're still on The New Yorker, the other thing I want to ask you, because this is really important, and I want to ask you, David, first, and then I'm going to go around to the fellas, and you have to be honest. And I know that you're going to have a lot of favorites. It's kind of like asking who's your favorite child, favorite New Yorker cartoon of all time. What is it? Describe it, please.
Oh, ask those guys first, then I'll think.
Okay. Sean or Jason?
Okay, I got it.
Sorry, David. Yeah, Sean and Jason, all right, so you're on ice again.
And it's completely self-involved, and it involves a gift. So I think one of the great comic geniuses in the country of any kind is Roz Chast. You guys know Roz Chast. And she has this kind of wobbly line, and her humor comes out of, you know, Brooklyn neurotic old parents who are school teachers. And when I turned 40, which... loath to admit it was some time ago. I was feeling pretty. I don't know how you guys turned 40. Yes, right? Yeah. It's not the best day of your life.
I currently play 38.
Yeah.
What was the question?
Like Jack Benny. And I contrived some reason to stay home from work that day. And yet this thing came was delivered to the house, a big framed thing. And it was Roz Chast had delivered, or the office had delivered or gotten me, this strip that Roz had done about her childhood and her obsession with Charles Adams, who was one of the great New Yorker cartoonists. And so that strip hangs in my apartment, and so I have to give that pride a place.
Yeah, she has a very distinctive style, Roz Chast.
She sure does.
Yeah, very, very cool, very funny. Sean, do you have one?
No, I don't read.
The New Yorker cartoons?
David, I want to ask you.
Hang on, we're still
cartoons,
doing this.
One sentence at a time.
Jason, do you have one?
I'm embarrassed to say that I just read the articles and not even as often as I would like to. I do not spend time with the cartoons.
Well, get to it.
Yeah, I was teeing myself up.
Okay, go ahead.
Good.
My
I was just going to say, keep in mind the title of this show is called Smartless. Go ahead.
Yeah, right. My favorite New Yorker cartoon, of which I have two framed versions because two people knew I loved it so much they gave it to me as gifts, is the image is a piece of penne. Do you know what I'm getting at? It's a piece of penne, pasta, and he's on the phone. He's picked up the phone. And he's saying, "Fusilli, you crazy bastard, how the hell are you?"
It looks better than it sounds.
It's incredible.
It's Charles Barsotti is the cartoonist, and I remember it well. I remember it well.
It's incredible. To me, it's the funniest joke of all time.
Well, you know the process how they do this. I mean, maybe it's the individual version of a writer's room, is that these guys, and then it's no, thank God, it's no longer all guys. It's much more diverse in all ways in recent years, which is the achievement in many ways of Emma Allen, the cartoon editor for the past several years, is, you know, the artists are at home all by their lonesome, and they do what's called roughs, you know, kind of a rough version of the drawing, and they just do ideas and ideas and ideas, and then they send them in, you know, mm-hmm. 6 a week, 10 a week, however many. And the cartoon editor goes through the huge stack, and then one day a week even has a meeting, and the people come in, like into a, you know, an emergency room or something, and one after another comes to see Emma, and they talk it through. And she whittles down the stack to about, I don't know, 50 or 60, and then she and I go through it, and we pick 20. It's pretty brutal.
No way.
It's very tough.
So fun.
That's tough.
Have you ever had to disqualify one that you regret, that you're like, oh, it was so... Has one ever stuck out to you that you thought...
Because it's too filthy or something?
Or something, or whatever.
Well, sometimes people make the same joke that we had 5 years ago. So our fact checkers... Mm. And we have a small army of wonderful fact checkers.
Of course.
Not only check the articles and for, you know, really drill down on the facts, but they also check cartoons. One, to make sure we haven't made this joke before. Two, that it's accurate.
Yeah.
Imagine that accuracy in
joke writing.
In humor. And if it's inaccurate, you work with the artist and do they want to do that? Do they want to say that the Empire State Building is only 100 feet tall or whatever. But so you want to get there. But they're like, I don't know. I've kind of come to think of cartoons as like little hand grenades. Either they blow up or they don't.
Well, but there's also the cultural hand grenade of it. Do you find yourself caught in between the potential perceived pressure on one side to have the satire be based in sort of wokeness, which you know, one could make an argument that the left-leaning base of the New Yorker would demand, versus the pressure from the other side saying, well, you guys are getting too far over here. Well, you don't even want us to read the magazine anymore.
It doesn't come in cartoons all that often. I think that you see that more in... political argument.
Yeah.
And I think it's less left-right as it is liberal, left, you know, radical, as it were.
Ah, gotcha.
At least in these precincts, that's where you see the tension. And I don't mean just New York, I just mean overall.
Yeah, sure. No, that's where the real battle is now. So to what degree do you guys respond to, or are you aware of social media and response? Because now the response is so immediate and so often filled with vitriol. To what degree does that drive or steer what you guys do, or how aware of it? How much of that?
It's a dilemma.
Yeah. Right.
It's a dilemma because on the one hand, I've made two really good decisions in my life for me. One was to marry my wife, who I'm married to for 30 years, and there seems to be no end in sight except for the, you know, mortality. And then the other one is to
She's not after this. We're going to ask her the same question.
She disagrees, rebuttal. By the way.
Yeah.
You should tune in.
We've got a rebuttal.
And then she will have a rebuttal. And the second thing was not to sign up for Twitter. Mm-hmm. Because people in jobs like mine, whether they're running the New York Times or the Atlantic or the Washington mm-hmm. Post or small magazine, whatever it is, they do one of two things. Either they quickly become unbelievably boring and say, we had a really good piece about this. Then we had a really good, it becomes promotional and then mm-hmm. nobody gives a damn.
Right.
Or somebody tweets at them something that pisses them off. And at 2 o'clock in the morning, after having a couple of beers or whatever their pleasure is, they decide to become honest. And that's a disaster.
Yeah.
That's a disaster. And I've seen that happen too. So, of course, I look at Twitter in the same way that Jimmy Stewart looked at his neighbor in Rear Window. Mm. I lurk because it's interesting. And if there is...
That's Jason's move.
I've heard that.
Do you have a... Is the circulation growing? Did you notice, like, over everything, print and social?
So here's what's happened to our business. The magazine business and the New Yorker's business used to be predominantly, by a huge majority, advertising.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then something happened in the world, and it's related to what we're just talking about. Google and Facebook in particular took up all the advertising in the world, like 75% of it.
Yeah. Wow.
So if you look at an issue of The New Yorker from 1967, it's fat with ads for products that most of don't even exist anymore, but it's fat with ads. If you look at the print magazine now, it's far less.
Mm-hmm.
So you would look at that and say, well, how the hell do they exist? We exist because we made a bet. And the bet was, in the old days, what you paid to subscribe was a trivial amount of money. The bet was, and thank God we it worked out, is we basically said to the reader, you need to pay a more reasonable price.
Mm.
How about as much as a small cup of coffee at Starbucks once a week.
Yeah.
So $150 a year.
Right.
And our readers, thank God, love The New Yorker enough so that they did this and so that we're doing okay. I mean, it ain't Facebook. It's not Google. It's,
right. Do you still do a lot of blow-ins on the...
Yeah, but most... You do that, but most people are subscribing, obviously, right. Digitally.
What are blow-ins?
Sorry, it's the magazine business. David and I know.
Sorry.
Little cards. But... The things that fall out of the print magazine. It's not what you think.
Just
of.
The right. Little... Yeah, just for... David,
well, David, I mean, you would never say this, but I'll say it. I mean, you're at the top of the mountain. Where do you see yourself going with a job? I mean, you just stay there till you die? I mean, could be better than being the editor of The New Yorker?
Jesus Christ, baby.
Well, I mean, I just...
You're asking about death?
Don't make him face his mortality this morning.
What do you want to do after this?
I face it every minute.
What could be better than this?
Well,
I'm speaking about the Smartless podcast.
That's right.
No. Being the editor of The New Yorker is the top of the mountain. A, how's the view? And B, what could you ever do after this? What would you want to do after this?
I'm unusual for most editors. I came to this through writing. In other words, I was a writer at The New Yorker after being at The Washington Post for 5-6 years. The editor was Tina Brown. One fine day she quit to go off to do another magazine, magazine.
They're talking about fireworks. Anyway, we won't get into that.
No.
And, between you and Dave.
I mean, and I really got and do get along exceptionally well with Tina. I think she's an exceptional talent and person.
Sure.
And I became editor in 1998. And I remember the conversation I had with my wife. She said, well, if it doesn't work out after a couple of years, you just quit and go back to writing.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It wasn't a couple of years, but at some point... if I, still have, I don't have scrambled eggs for a brain, I'll write again.
Yeah.
And I'm 62 years old. I shouldn't stay there forever. The great editor of The New Yorker in the 60s, 70s, and into the 80s was William Shawn. But he kept at it until he was almost 80. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure that's a brilliant idea.
I'd love to see you take over for Charlie Rose. I used to love, that's why I first started falling in love with you, just watching those great conversations you guys used to have. And I miss his show. And I'd love to see somebody like you
take
over
say.
For that.
I'd like to see you take over for Jason on Smartless. David, I was going to say, so you win, you're not only were you a writer, you're a writer with considerable acclaim and I forget the title of your book that you wrote that you won the Pulitzer for. Was it
Lenin's Tomb?
Lenin's Tomb.
It was about the collapse of the Soviet Union.
Right. Lenin's Tomb. And then you become an editor at The New Yorker. Mm-hmm. It's a gear shift. Of course,
it's
a massive gear shift to go. It's kind of like, going from actor to director, which Jason knows all too well. You're staying within the same discipline, if you will, but you're looking at it from a different perspective.
Well, it's other people. It's
right.
Other people. In other words, a writer, what I want to create for writers at The New Yorker is a kind of paradise. In other words, that they know they're making a living, but equally important that they have the freedom to explore the things that they want to explore and have the time to do it where that's appropriate. Mm-hmm. And that's not the case at a newspaper.
Yeah.
A newspaper, you're assigned very often to X or, and I was, and I was perfectly happy at it for 10 years. And my last assignment was Heaven on Earth, meaning Moscow. Mm. But I want at The New Yorker people never, ever, ever to be working on something that bores them or they're not mm-hmm. interested in.
What were those last days like in Moscow as it fell with Gorbachev and then going into Yeltsin and all that stuff? What was that like, just sort of as an observant, not even just from a news standpoint, just sort of watching that whole shift?
I've never been a war correspondent. And war correspondents, when you ask them that, you're never getting a full answer because there's so much tragedy and horror and fear and peril involved that they never can... Unless they're writing their fullest book and from their fullest soul, you never get a full picture. I can answer your question because really it was a revolution in which, I mean, there were people who died in certain incidents in Georgia and Azerbaijan and certain areas. But, even the coup that ended the whole thing in August of 1991, 3 people were killed. Mm. I mean, which is a tragedy for them and their families and everybody they know. But how often does that happen? It was, to answer your question, thrilling. My wife and I lived in a tiny crappy apartment, and we worked from 9 a.m, she for the New York Times, me for the Washington Post, from 9 a.m. till 2 a.m. every day for 4 years, and never regretted a second of it. And even on the rare moments when we went out of the country and were on kind of relative vacation, we missed it and couldn't wait to get back.
Mm-hmm. Wow. How drunk was everybody?
Well, here's the thing. So I'm a Jew. You might have possibly guessed this. And so I found myself, you know, at these occasions, pouring the vodka into the potted plants half the time because I can't keep up. I can't do it.
That's hilarious.
And we will be right back.
Hey, Smartless listener. We get support from Viator. You know, Scotty and I took a vacation many years ago. We geeked out because we liked the movie Amadeus, and we went to Austria, and it was fantastic. We went to all Mozart's kind of hangout places. And I know, total nerdville, but it was pretty cool. And I absolutely loved it. It will always be one of our favorite memories of vacationing. So maybe one of the most perfect experiences we've ever had traveling. And so next time you're looking to plan the perfect trip like that, an experience, check out Viator. Viator is a tool you can use to plan and book travel experiences around the world. Their app and website make it easy to explore 300,000 plus travel experiences so you can discover what's out there no matter where you are traveling or what you are interested in. Feel better about your travel decisions by checking out real traveler reviews to get the inside scoop from others who have already checked out the experiences. Viator offers 24/7 customer service so you know you'll get support at any hour if things aren't going as planned. Plus, free cancellation to help you plan for the unexpected. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find the perfect travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator. From visionary filmmaker Luca Guadagnino comes Challenger, starring Zendaya, Josh O'Connor, and Mike Feist. Zendaya stars as Tashi Duncan, a former tennis prodigy turned coach who has taken her husband Art and transformed him into a world-famous Grand Slam champion. To jolt him out of his recent losing streak, she makes him play a challenger event close to the lowest level of the pro tournament. Her strategy takes a turn when he finds himself standing across the net from his former best friend and Tashi's former boyfriend, Patrick. Past and present collide and tensions run high. Tashi must ask herself, what will it cost to win? See Challengers only in theaters April 26th. Get tickets now at ChallengersMovie.com.
My dad works in B2B marketing, but I never really knew what that meant. Then one day, my dad came by my school for career day and told everyone in my class he was a big ROAS man. Then he just kept saying things like, the bigger the ROAS, the better, over and over. My friends still laugh at me to this day. I think it means calculating a return on ad spend. One thing's for sure. I'll be known as the ROAS man's kid for the rest of my days. Why couldn't you just be a fireman or a lawyer? Why? You ruined my life, Dad.
Not everyone gets B2B, but LinkedIn has the people who do. And with ads on LinkedIn, you'll be able to reach people based on job title, industry, likelihood to buy, and more. Start converting your B2B audience into high-quality leads today. We'll even give you a $100 credit on your next ad campaign. Go to linkedin.com/smartlist to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/smartless. Terms and conditions apply. LinkedIn, the place to be, to be.
It's all a lighthearted nightmare on our podcast, Morbid.
We're your hosts. I'm Alina Urquhart.
And I'm Ash Kelly.
And our show is part true crime, part spooky, and part comedy.
The stories we cover are well-researched.
He claimed and confessed to officially killing up to 28 people.
With a touch of humor.
I just like to go ahead and say that if there's no band called Malevolent Deity,
that is pretty great.
A dash of sarcasm and just garnished a bit with a little bit of cursing.
This motherfucker lied.
Like a liar.
Like a liar.
And if you're a weirdo like us and love to cozy up to a creepy tale of the paranormal,
or you love to hop in the Wayback Machine and dissect the details of some of history's most notorious crimes,
you should tune in to our podcast, Morbid. Follow Morbid on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to episodes early and ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
All right, back to the show.
Wait, back to the New Yorker. Do you have a favorite interview of all time that you've ever done? Or,
well, I mean, they've ranged from Howard Stern to Alexander Solzhenitsyn to
right.
To little. I occasionally get a chance still to write pieces, and I've been on a streak of writing about older musicians. Mm. And right before the election in 2016, a friend of mine was friends in California with Leonard Cohen. Mm. who I really admired. And he said, do you want to meet Leonard? And I flew out to L.A. We met. We talked for 5 hours. He's the most unbelievably eloquent, prolific, charming man.
Great Canadian.
A great Montrealer, yes.
Yeah, great Montrealer.
And so I asked to interview him. And, you know, usually these profiles, and you've been through this process, usually these profiles, when they're not just junket things, you're spending a lot of time with them. You're going to this. You're seeing that. By this time, Leonard was in his 80s, and he was, frankly, dying. He had a number of illnesses, and he knew what was up. And so all this piece involved, which ended up being, I don't know, 10,000 words, which is long, was sitting there for 2 days and asking him questions for 5-6 hours each time, including a moment on the second day when he was furious with me and my friend because we screwed up the time and we were late or whatever happened. And he accused us of torturing a dying man, which is not what you want to hear from Leonard Cohen.
No.
You really don't.
Doesn't yield a lot of open answers.
Oh, no, I felt terrible. But I just found him to be a person of really profound depth and wit and learning. And I don't know how he managed with all the women because he was easily the most charming person I ever met. Ever.
Yeah.
Ever.
Will, how do you do it?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, David, you're just getting to know me, but I suspect that there's going to be a 200,000 word.
I'm feeling it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
David, what is the dumbest thing that you enjoy doing? Every day or every week, or is it a crappy reality show? Is it?
I watch more TV than I'm really willing to admit right here.
And you still get time to read and everything like that. I mean,
yeah,
it's
to my advantage that I don't sleep very well.
What's your guilty pleasure that people would be surprised to hear about?
I just watch one of these. You know, there's all these Nordic thrillers, and some of them are really good, right?
Great.
Some of them are really good. That. There's also some that are incredibly boring.
Yeah.
I mean, so this one was set in Iceland. I remember. And it wasn't even in Reykjavik. It was so boring. It was in a bad town up the fjord or whatever.
I know the one you're talking about.
I couldn't follow a thing. And yet I it was just heaven to watch it because it was like, I don't.
But that's still you watching something highbrow. I'm talking about.
That wasn't
what
highbrow.
Is the stupid ass thing that you do?
No, this is highbrow to him. It's highbrow to him. Sorry, David, keep going.
No, I'll tell you, and you know, I also, for my sins, we do a podcast called the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Mm-hmm.
And which I find enormously fun. But I have such a hard time sleeping late at night. What I do is I find the most boring podcast I possibly can, and that's it. 10 minutes.
You're welcome.
Please say it's us.
No, it's not. I promise you.
Could you make a commitment today to write a hit piece on Sean and Jason? Can you just like a real, I want one of these real hit pieces that just takes them apart.
Can you just take them down?
Take them right down to the studs.
No, I want to ask you guys something. You guys have all had reporters come to you. When a reporter approaches you, is it like when a mountain lion approaches you on a walk through the hills of L.A.? Or how much trepidation is
there? I have to tell you, I figure it took me years and years to figure this out. But a lot of times journalists will, whether it's on camera or print or whatever, they'll ask you a question they know is a little racy or that you don't want to go there, you don't want to answer.
Yeah.
And I finally learned this tactic they do. They'll ask you a question and then they'll wait. And they'll let you fill the awkward space.
It's the oldest trick in the book.
Right?
That's Howard. I told Howard that. Howard Stern does the very thing. The first time I did Howard Stern, I go in there and I go, I figured out, Howard, what you do is he it's a rope-a-dope, right? So he brings up stupid thing. You get into dumb conversations about whatever it is.
Right. And, psychoanalysis.
Right. And then what he does is, then he says, and yeah, of course, somebody will bring it on and say, and yeah, and you had an awkward thing with the police.
Right.
And you go, and there's a pause, and he goes, and he says, go ahead. and right. suggesting that you had brought it up.
He's changed.
Right? I agree. He's changed.
But what I learned was then just to have a staring contest. Now I don't answer until they keep going.
Yeah. Did you win?
I'm just completely quiet.
Must be a great piece that resulted from.
Yeah,
that.
Absolutely. It's about a page.
Like Zen
it's about
Buddhism.
20 words.
You know what's annoying that reporters do, and it's generally not print reporters because they're much more engaging in it and they're looking for actual answers. But oftentimes you'll do something and they'll say. They'll go, so Lego Movie.
Yeah. There's no question.
And I started to get to the point where I just go, what? There's no question here. They'll go, or they'll go, that was fun.
Yeah.
Oh, the best is in sports. And I experienced, I covered the First of all, I want you to know I was the Washington Federals correspondent for the Washington Post. This was the USFL.
Oh, my God.
And I was the second string boxing correspondent.
Second string.
But the my favorite thing is, you know, you're in a locker room, which has kind of receded. Now it's much more formal and it's press conferencing. But you just go in a locker room and the guys, you know, with the radio mics would just go, LeBron, that shot. And then they'd extend, everybody would extend their arms with the microphone. Right. But LeBron knew what to do.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
And I was such an idiot that I would think I have to ask a really good question. And so I was covering the Bullets, as they were named now. They're the Wizards, because Bullets was not good with the murder rate in Washington at that time.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
true. What happened to that?
And the best player on that team was Jeff Ruland, who, by the way, was not so good, but that's what we had. And I said, you know, Ralph Sampson is coming into the league, and how do you think Ralph Sampson's going to be? Is he going to be a great NBA center? This was week two of the season, 82 games. He would not speak to me for the rest of the year. Wow. So good questions can you know, yeah. screw you up.
What's your sports passion now? Is it basketball?
Basketball. I'm with the Nets.
The Nets.
Yeah, the Nets are a great team.
They are stacked.
You know, in this new world of what's it called, player empowerment.
Yeah.
You know, in which everybody seeks, you know, the superstars all seek each other in this kind of new way of doing business. Yeah,
well, the players decide where the dynasty is going to be, right?
Well, and the agent, you know, we just ran a profile of Rich Paul, who's LeBron's agent, and he's the pioneer in this.
Yeah.
Ask me what I'm thinking of right now.
Oh, how about cupcakes, maybe, or just a fresh bag of cookies?
Dr. Brown soda with a little cupcake.
Sean, as soon as we're done, Sean is like, I know Sean. Here's Sean's schedule for today.
He's going to watch last night's hockey playoffs.
Either he goes in the kitchen and he makes a tuna salad sandwich on white bread with chips, with plain chips on the side. Okay, so he either does that.
That's not a Jewish meal, Sean.
Or he orders food and he'll get in the car himself because he doesn't like other people grabbing his food and he'll go pick up. He won't do delivery. This is true. And he'll go, and he'll get in the car sometimes, and he drives close to where I live, and I go, where are you going? It's like, you know, 7 o'clock at night. He's like, I'm going to pick up dinner. I'm like, you know, they have Postmates. He's like, no, I don't want them to pick up.
And then you go, and then 5 o'clock is bowling league.
Can we go back to the part where you watch repeat hockey games?
Yeah, that's a sarcasm.
That is really,
Sean still thinks there's four quarters in a hockey game.
Sean doesn't. I do, in fact, but Sean does not. I watch.
He balances us out, you know.
I just can't do it.
Chalkboard play by play.
David, we could hang out with you all day because you make us feel better about ourselves. And I didn't get to half of my pre-written questions. I was so proud of the way I wrote them. And
what's your toughest one, Jason?
They're all political and boring, but
let's let it go.
Yeah, I love you, your brain, your kindness, and all of that stuff. And I'd love to have you come back, please.
This was really fun.
David, for you, I pray that you never find yourself like in a social situation where Jason is stuck to you and he's hammering you with, and at first you're thinking, I'm talking to Jason Bateman, he's great from Ozark and stuff. And 4 minutes in, you're like, I will sever my own limbs off to get out of this fucking guy.
Here's the thing, Ozark scared the shit out of me. Oh my God!
I pray for you, David.
It's we're doing the last season now. It's a musical, so it'll
is
be.
It?
Fun.
Very
it's
welcome.
I will rewatch.
What a departure!
We just made news right there.
Yeah, I think that's a great turn. Yeah.
There's a lot of that's a fun great turn. Bits.
You can't live on plot alone.
No,
David. It was a pleasure meeting you.
David, thank you so much. What a pleasure.
Great to see you.
Thank you, David. Very much.
Thanks, David.
Bye, buddy.
All right, man. Take care.
Bye, buddy.
Take care.
Bye, bye.
Oh, you know, I have so many questions for him. I feel like he could really solve a lot of our issues. Why isn't somebody like that in charge?
He's a smarty pants.
Because
he is in charge over there at the magazine.
Because it's the most thankless thing to do now.
Hey, but you know, we don't have to go on and on about this, but you know that thing about that when I said, it feels like there's nothing else we can do but vote. You know what I mean? Like that feel. Yeah. And he's like, no, there's more. There's tons you do. I just don't know that people know what to do or where to go or how to help. People just don't know and they want to. I mean, you know.
He said art. I think he means graffiti.
Yeah. You got to tag stuff.
Yeah, just get into tag. Let's start a tag crew. The three of us.
Yeah. You just have to turn your hat sideways a little bit, right?
Dude, let me get my visor on.
Yeah.
Good to go.
I feel like it's all about penetrating those
Excuse
who...
Excuse me? Excuse me, sir.
It's about trying to get to the people that don't listen to facts or don't have access to... I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know.
No, either. I think he's right, though. It is like by people continuing to write. It is art. I mean, that seems to be the way that it always happens.
Right, and eventually.
Through education.
Yeah.
The most chilling thing he said to me was he said that at the end of it all, and if it doesn't work, then maybe we didn't deserve it.
I know. I was like, oh, wow.
Christ. And yeah. You know what? He's kind of right. Maybe we don't. And it's
we'll
like.
We'll be dead by then.
Well, yeah. It's like the idea that like, okay, well, you don't think that anybody deserves to. You don't think that people should be taken care of and you don't be. And then ultimately, that's going to be you that's not taken care of.
Do you feel like this new family in your old house is taking care of you?
Mm. I got to see. I don't know. I don't know if I can call them family yet, but I do know that there's a lot of love down there.
Uh-huh. Oh boy!
And I might.
What about if you leave your little sound booth right now? Open up the door. You're going downstairs to say goodbye and everything. And they're all. What if they like just got out of the shower and they all the towel on and someone's on the couch just farting, watching TV. Like you don't want that to be the last vision of your house. People just almost literally peeing on the furniture.
First of all, what do you think?
You got to sneak out of there.
You know, listen. This is a nice. These are nice people. So what is the scene you're describing?
I just don't. Why would you want your last image to be somebody else nesting in your place? Are you going to be all right?
It's
with
not
that?
Exactly. Well, it's not what I wanted, man. This is the situation I'm in.
Well, Sean and I are doing it on a laptop. You don't need to be in your sound booth.
This is where all my stuff is, dude.
Guess what? You unplug the laptop. It is made to be portable.
Here's the other thing, because I have a lot of other voice commitments, so that I'm just lugging around, schlepping everything up and down.
Plug a mic into your laptop.
And now I got to go back and forth between here and where I'm currently living.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I'm Googling words that begin with bye.
Are you?
Oh, my God. You're the worst. That's all you think about when we do our little post wrap-up is,
are you
going to win the bye competition?
I know. You know what? Fucking, you're banned for a week.
Yeah, you're out.
You're out. You can't call bye. You cannot call bye for a week because you've just disqualified yourself.
Oh, my God,
yourself.
I'm crying.
Yeah, that's like using a computer for a crossword puzzle.
Yeah. You know? What are you doing?
Yeah, you can't do bye. What's the best one you came up with there, Sean? Which one are you excited about?
Read them out, you dick.
Bylaws, but that was BYE.
I used that one.
Oh, you did?
Are we allowed to recycle? That's a question.
No, you're not. And you know what else you're not allowed to do is fucking chew gum on a podcast. What are you doing?
Sorry, I just put it back in when David...
I saw that.
God, that was funny.
Do you want to know what kind of gum I chew?
No.
Okay, then nobody will know.
Oh, great.
Way to go. You just denied our listener from hearing what kind of gum I chew.
Well, you know, if you chew it too hard, you might accidentally bite your cheek.
I did it. Bite.
Did I do it?
Bite.
Bite.
Smart.
Smartless is 100% organic and artisanally handcrafted by Bennett Barbaco, Michael Grant Terry, and Rob Armjarf. If you like Smartless, you can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music. Before you go, tell us about yourself by filling out a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Get to the chopper. I'll be back. Listen, I gotta tell ya, of all guests we've had on Smartless, I don't know if we've had a bigger icon on our podcast than Arnold Schwarzenegger. I mean, what a treat it was talking to that guy. Arnold is an inspiration, from having reached the heights of bodybuilding to then conquer Hollywood and become a global movie star. Oh, and for his third act, he oversaw the world's fifth largest economy as governor of California. The man has truly done it all. In our interview, he shares the secret of how he's able to accomplish what he puts his mind to, what motivates him to keep working out all these years, and the extreme generosity that he received after arriving in America. You gotta listen to this episode to hear what it's like to be Chris Pratt's father-in-law and how Arnold's first comedy, Twins, has made him more money than any other film he's done. Hint, he's also a great businessman. Give it a listen if you haven't. Bye. Seps.